So yeah, landscape, perspectives from art and scripture. So this session, so this workshop comes out of a couple of different things for me. One is reflecting on some of the, just the term landscape as a word. It's something that I find I use often in talking about, words like land and landscape, because it's a major theme in both the art that I create, creating photos. I like the term intimate landscape because it's a photo that's not necessarily a huge wide scope of a landscape, but details and very small quiet scenes within the landscape is what I find myself most drawn to photograph. So I use that term a lot, intimate landscape, but it's something that comes up. People often ask me, so you're a photographer, what do you take pictures of? And I hesitate because I feel a little bit of discomfort saying I make photographs of landscape or I'm a nature photographer because of a lot of the assumptions that come with that about like what landscape is. And I think it's one of those terms that we use a lot and we don't always unpack. What do we mean by landscape? What are we talking about with landscape? And I think a lot of, especially art and landscape has been co-opted by, you know, like you walk into like the dental office or something like that and you see art on the walls that's like, oh, it's landscape art because that's what's beautiful and, you know, easily accessible. And so it can be challenging to do, create art about landscape, I think because of a lot of the assumptions we bring to what we look at when we look at the land. And a lot of, those different thoughts about it. And so it's a subject that carries a lot of complexities, but I think that we often oversimplify, or even when we look at landscapes, we think, oh, it's, you know, this is a beautiful thing, and looking at why something is beautiful, and what is it that connects us with beauty when we look at land, and how, and what challenges us, and making photographs that sometimes challenge or disrupt our assumptions about the land, and complexify our thinking is really important too, and something that I'm always seeking after. So that, and then the other sort of current behind the wonderings and questions that drove this particular topic today is looking at different influences that have been important to me in my art creating and photography. So I want to share the work of four other photographers who have influenced me and who I've drawn from in both how they make photographs of landscape and also ways that they explore and dig deeper under the surface for art making with landscape as a subject. So, But just to start, I'm curious, what are the things that come to mind when you hear the term landscape? Can you share that?
As somebody who's not creating art, I think of the printer at the computer. Do you want a portrait or landscape?
Yes!
That's the first thing that came to my mind.
No, that's awesome. Yeah.
So horizontal.
Yes, yes, and that is ongoing theme in landscape is horizon.
Yeah.
That's a really,
horizon,
really
sure.
good point. Yeah. And landscape being
distance.
Yeah.
Sometimes.
Ansel Adams.
Yeah.
Human influence on landscape.
Yeah. Their thoughts could be anything. Free association. What kind, and you know, if other images or things come to mind?
I think just the landscape that I grew up looking at kind of comes to mind. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Front yard.
Yeah.
so you get a feeling of that interaction.
Yeah, definitely. From like a human perspective.
Kind of changing landscape, but changing landscape, I feel fortunate to live in a place where I can look at two different sets of mountains, glaciated mountains, lots of salt water, and it just depends on which way I go. I mean, people orient themselves in Seattle to whether they're, you know, the Cascades are to the east and the Olympics are to the west, and that helps you when you're new in town. So having grown up in the Midwest, my landscape was more the horizon.
That's, I mean, what I think of too is Midwestern landscape. And my parents live out in just outside of Lincoln, Nebraska, kind of in the countryside. It's a lot of field and farm and running dirt roads and like blinding midsummer heat, because when I'm visiting my parents, I usually sleep through the best running hours of the morning. And so like with sweat in my eyes, like running down dusty gravel roads and seeing this like wash of sky and field that just meet. And I often tell people it reminds me of like running into a Rothko painting. It's just like, you know, really complex mix of planes of color. And that's one of my favorite ways to image and think about the landscape.
Landscape doesn't have to be nature. It's about it's more about what lives on land and the scape of it, which is the whiteness of it. It is how you are seeing it from a, you know, vertical or horizontal point of view. It's whatever that lives on the land, and there is horizon that meets the sky. Yeah. That's the scape of it. So a city could be a landscape, and you can say the landscape of the city is made out of lots of buildings. You know? So it doesn't necessarily have to be the Flint Hills or nature. That's my perspective of what landscape means, is whatever that lives on that land, the vastness of it, the scape.
And I mean, on that note, we use the term landscape to talk about periods of time or like large areas of thought. The landscape of Christian esoteric ramblings about theology today, you know, it's like it becomes a word to talk about a broad space and area of ideas or dialogue too, or non-natural built areas or space generally. I think about it, when I'm photographing even small indoor or abstract spaces, it's still sort of a landscape of space that you navigate. So yeah, it carries all these different terms. And to that point about urban landscape, and also about human influence on the land, I find it interesting to notice the way that human influence is either avoided or embraced in making art about landscape. I think one way that land has often been treated in, especially the American idea about nature or wilderness, is this separation. And there are some times where we border here a wilderness area, and that separation is one that is so important in terms of protection and conservation. You know, you're talking about parks all week, and it was fascinating the first time I was here learning about the restrictions of what tools you can use in a designated wilderness area and ways that we have parameters of setting land aside for different purposes. But also some of the other end of that is when we assume this like separation from the land or the landscape that's not there. And that's something that I actually found myself assuming in my early days of picking up a camera, I found myself really hesitating to show human influence. It's like, no, it's supposed to be this like pure, perfect nature image. I can't show human influence on it, you know? And that just recognizing that that was my assumption and ideal as a very young person made me think about, wow, this is the sort of dominant narrative too. What are ways of kind of working within that, pushing back against that in different ways? So that's something that I often am looking for or thinking about when making images. So you mentioned Ansel Adams, and I'm gonna turn these lights on. It is really hard to see these. So Ansel Adams is, there we go. You know, everyone knows and often thinks of in terms of looking at landscape. And he actually had quite a bit of influence on me when I was learning silver gelatin printing in the darkroom. And he would just do these amazing, intricate photographs of perfectly balancing the light. And you know, this is long, pre-Photoshop, dodging and burning to make sure the light goes in the right places to get the exposure just right. And just the beautiful varieties of grays and blacks and whites. Being a soul that feels very compelled to black and white photography and silver gelatin prints. And there's something weighty and magical about just the beautiful variation of tones that come through in these very organic and elaborate and stunning landscapes. But what was interesting to me too, I mean, it's also something that's been very romanticized and sometimes feels like, oh, it's so cliched, but there's also something really deep and striking and resonant about his work that is so, I mean, it's just been resonant through the ages. So it's kind of impossible to like not include him in the conversation here. I was gonna share an interesting conversation that I heard, heard written about in a book about landscape and art, was a conversation between Ansel Adams and Henri Cartier-Bresson, who is this famous street photographer shooting in France, both working in the early 1900s, early mid-1900s, and Henri Cartier-Bresson was addressing it, like shooting in very urban areas, shooting a lot of people, really concerned about the issues happening in society, and made this remark to the press saying, the world is going to pieces, and people like Ansel Adams and Edward Wesson are out there photographing rocks. And I just thought that was really funny. And also, but Ansel Adams replied then to the press, seeing this come out, and really wanting to stake a claim for the importance of creating art about the wild spaces, said, well, but photographing a rock is just as socially significant as a line of unemployed. And it's a pretty audacious statement, but I really like the point that he was making about the social implications of the landscape and how connected these rocks and trees and inanimate objects are to this emerging modern industrial society, and how relevant these rocks and trees are to our current just already past the boom and trying to figure out our fraught relationship with the land society, and how socially significant the stories of these wild spaces and rocks and trees in the non-wild spaces are and what they have to say. And I think what's interesting about landscape photography or landscape in art is what it has to say is not going to like hit you over the head saying, oh, this rock is telling this story, because it's kind of impossible to do that. But what the photographs evoke or create space for in terms of trying to bring in attentiveness and ear to the voice of the land is really intriguing to me. And I just love that Ansel Adams was making that connection and sticking up for that. And then he also did a lot of conservation work. So the John Muir Trail series, he was photographing, I'm gonna make sure I get my points right here. Yeah, in 1938 is when this came out, and he was photographing as a part of the Sierra Club's efforts to secure the designation of the Sequoia and Kings Canyon as national parks. And the book actually became a part of a testimony before Congress and was a part of persuading both elected officials and people of the importance of the land and protecting rather than letting some of these areas be either settled or excavated or whatnot for their resources. So that's pretty fascinating. But yeah, I'm sure you all know Ansel Adams. Do you have other thoughts or comments about this particular perspective on landscape?
I'd offer a comment, and yeah, that is sure. That Adams was hired by the National Park Service and given a budget to go out and photograph the national parks for months and months. And that says something about the agency, I think, and its view of what is worth protecting or preserving, perhaps, to distinguish between preservation and protection, often seen as the same. But I think that though he was well known as a photographer, it's my understanding before he was hired, it would be like for me 25 years ago being hired by the National Geographic to go take photographs in Africa, for example, and knowing that there would be a use made of my work.
Yeah.
You know, I might shoot 10,000 photos. Maybe five of them would be worthy of being included in a publication.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, it says something about, what is the purpose of the art and creating these portrayals of landscape for particular use or story, method, vehicle of agency or storytelling, or with National Geographic, who is investing in these images and why? How does that shape what's happening and allow it to happen too? Yeah,
I love the synchronicity that these two sessions are back to back and so well related. I don't know if that was planned or just a happy coincidence, but what strikes me is that part of Ansel Adams' work makes me think of the, be careful what you ask for, pray for, whatever, because you might get it, because largely because of his work, especially in Yosemite, you can't even get into Yosemite anymore. So we've gone from, in less than 100 years, of being pretty much ignorant of what was available to us as a people, to loving it to death, almost, or being in danger of loving it to death.
Yeah, that's a good point too about access.
I think the photographs of Adams is just directly related to the early efforts to set aside land. And so you began with artists, as I was talking about the other day in a session, that were depicting places like Yellowstone. And accompanying the artists was William Henry Jackson, a photographer, in the same lineage as Ansel Adams, only decades before him, you know, shooting photos of similar things, and those messages were used by proponents to set aside land, and Congress was persuaded by the magnificent art, very romantic views of like Yellowstone Falls, and accompanied by Moran's photos, helps convince the Congress to pass legislation that sets aside land like Yellowstone or Yosemite, which was really set aside before but wasn't managed by the National Park Service until the 80s, as opposed to 1864, is my recollection. Yosemite was set aside.
So similar but different is more of the National Geographic type vein of documenting and portraying a landscape through the life of its inhabitants and through kind of landscape portraiture as well. So I wanted to share the work of wildlife photographer, conservationist photographer, Michael Forsberg is his name, who is from Lincoln, Nebraska, and is a friend of my family, and grew up going to church with him and his family and babysat his kids. And he was a really important mentor to me when I first started picking up a camera and wandering around in the Nebraska landscape. So sitting and hearing his story was really interesting. He grew up in rural Nebraska, and his grandparents had a farm, and they spent a lot of time out there and was captivated by these sandhill cranes. They're very beautiful and tall. They're about this tall standing, you know, and also very awkward looking when they fly. Their feet stick right out, and they are kind of quirky birds that have this really loud and beautiful, if kind of clunky, sort of call to them. And they have the largest convergence of the migration on the Platte River, right not too far from Lincoln, where I grew up. And so these birds are a really important part of the Great Plains landscape as a whole, but particularly for Nebraska, it's a real point of pride and connection. And so seeing the Nebraska landscape through these birds and through the eyes of a wildlife photographer who I learned a great deal from really shaped some of my understandings about attentiveness to the landscape too. So his images go from everything like this very quiet kind of ephemeral portrait where you see these birds calling and likely the mist and fog of the early morning to much more document kind of style. So the migration goes as far south into Mexico and as far north as up through Canada and parts of Alaska. So it's a hugely expansive migration. And what was interesting to me is seeing how he photographed these birds over the course of 5 years, actually. He followed the migration up and down across North America, and how he photographed these birds both told about the landscape and how it moves, where water moves. The Platte is a very, very shallow, wide river, so it's the best place for them to roost in that halfway point along the migration. And the Platte River is actually struggling a lot now. Here's a photo from more of the on the river sort of part of the migration. But the Platte River has so many demands on it from permaculture and just record-setting high temperatures every year that the Platte River is being drained, and there's not that perfect level of water to cover the sandbanks, and so weeds and all sorts of grasses have started growing on the sandbanks, which totally disrupts the crane migration. And so it's a very important conservation point to be documenting and photographing these birds and showing how changes in demands on the landscape influence this really beloved part of Nebraska.
Is he shooting with film or digital?
Digitally, yeah. I'm sure, I know some of his early work was film, but he made the transition to digital, like most wildlife and landscape photographers who shoot in more of this documentary, National Geographic type vein.
And do you know if he's affiliated with the International Crane Foundation?
I do not know that. I'm not sure. He spent a ton of time learning about the cranes and their migration.
He must be.
Making partnerships and all these kinds of things. So I'm sure he has. The title of his book is On Ancient Wings, and it's this beautiful coffee table book that's has gotten a lot of attention. It came out a number of years ago, so I'm not sure how it's shaken out since then, but I know it has it in a lot of ways. But telling the story about how they're threatened and ways of working with the sandhill cranes too, I find really fascinating. So like the point we were talking about earlier is, you know, where do humans play into the landscape, and in what ways do images actually reference or sometimes dare to show very direct human influence. And so photographs like that one, and I just love this too, say something really interesting about the relationship between these kids walking down the street in a little town and these, you know, maybe teenage cranes, who knows how old they are. But it tells a different story to show that or the ungraceful landings and the more quirky sides of the birds than just the sort of beautiful in-flight sort of photo. So, and then this too is cornfields, you know, and so how the diet and patterns of these birds have changed based on agriculture even, and how human settlement of this huge swath of the migration has changed. And then finally, this is another altered landscape, so trees planted as a windbreak along farm field. And so landscape can take many forms and tell a lot of different stories, and the ways it tells stories about settled land and birds and how they're affected and what their story is. It's really another way to come at the very large topic of art and landscape.
The background looks almost like it's painted.
Yeah.
You don't see clouds like that anymore.
Any thoughts, reactions to
this question?
Are
the trees shadowed in the water or not? Are those shadows in the water of the trees? Are the roots of the trees in the water? Maybe that's another way to ask it.
Oh, I don't think so. I would assume this is out a windbreak.
On the shoreline?
A windbreak between farm fields, I would guess.
There's no
there's
water.
Not, I don't think there's
no water.
There's no water, huh? Okay.
Yeah, it's just...
But that's an interesting illusion.
Yeah.
Because I can see why I would see
how
that.
How you would see.
Yeah.
No, it's what when I was mentioning almost like a Rothko painting, like field and sky, it's just like flat land and sky without a lot of water or you know, change in elevation in the horizon.
You could really imagine that that was the ocean behind the trees, and that there's a horizon of ocean meeting sky.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
If you wanted to play visually with that.
Part of what you're seeing is also, I don't know, another layer of trees in front of the trees that are on the back. That's
It could easily be the silhouette of a tree reflected in the water in front of it. And then that piece of land right in the foreground gives me an impression that it's slightly rises. It's not flat, in other words, right here in the foreground.
Yeah.
It's deceiving in the sense of what my eye saw.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
In the distance.
Yeah. Well, one other final thought about this particular artist's work is also the way that beauty functions for him is one, he talks a lot about the Great Plains not being thought of offhand as beautiful or even sometimes inhabited or having inherent value. And so his work as a photographer, teasing out these, this is just farm field, but in different parts and places, really showing the quiet and subtle beauty of the landscape is really important in his work, which is cool to see. So in a very different vein, this is an artist named Beth Dow, who is a Minnesota native, a practicing artist photographer in the Twin Cities area who's done work all around. A dear friend of my photography professor from undergrad, so I got to hear her speak when she came and shared and worked with her a little bit in one of the photography classes that I was taking. And I'm really struck by her work because she works also in historic and alternative process, so using film. These are, I believe, all platinum palladium prints, and so that's why they look very semi-tone, brown tones, because of actually the historic process. So it was using the chemicals of palladium and a little bit of platinum, which is an even more expensive and rare chemical. And the way that chemistry reacts to UV light is what creates the photograph. The image is traced in light that way. And she did this project of photographing the series. These images are from a series called In the Garden, and they were taken in formal English and Italian gardens. And she talks about attending to the mystery and shape and natural spaces of these very cultivated and curated gardens. And so she's dealing with landscape as it's very formalized and controlled and poised, which is very fascinating. So this is the human built landscape for the purpose of poise and distinguishment and beauty in a different sense. And it's interesting to me to see how she crops and sets up these photographs. So you find these kind of, some that are more like, this reminds me more of a park or a forest as you would find it. This is almost showing some of the like oddness of the shapes and patterns of created gardens. And so a lot of, you know, shrubs and very meticulously trimmed and cultivated things that have also a kind of haunting and mysterious elegance to them, walking through this line where you're enclosed by green walls is something very mysterious and evokes a different kind of experience. So she shows everything from these very, you know, unique and stylized landscapes. I love this with the hat and all of these lines, the building lines right behind it with the triangle of the tree. And then included in this beautiful, meticulous series is this one little jab of the wildness of a bush that had not been properly trimmed or had at least not been trimmed recently. And she talked about, and she shared these photos of showing both the control and beauty and sort of mystical space of these built garden environments, but including some of this unruly wildness of an uncontrollability of, or uncontrollable nature, variability and spunk of the land kind of having its own little jab.
It's interesting too that if I were editing this or going to put it in a publication, mm-hmm. I would be trying to find, you know, the horizontal and it's impossible to find a horizontal in that. And she's got lines going this way and that way and down and around. Mm-hmm. I don't see a horizontal, a true horizontal there.
It looks like she loves graphic forms.
Yeah,
you know,
yes.
And noticing that she likes a lot of things that are a combination or a juxtaposition between or something organic like mm-hmm. that and something very graphic.
Yeah.
Like the round thing earlier, very Zen garden, and she's playing with composition.
Yeah.
Or this one, it's very Japanese and it's mm-hmm. a combination of two things. Really nice.
Yeah, definitely. And then this one that's all very organic shape, but you've got the one line of the wall. And I love this with the bark of the tree and then this kind of cone of these shaped shrubs.
It's beautiful.
Has she put together several images in this particular photograph? Is that a composite of two or three photographs?
I believe it's just one.
You think so? Okay.
Yeah.
Or she's a multi. Did she multi-layer?
Yeah. It looks like the tree on the left looks to me like a sequoia. But you wouldn't find it with a locust, which is the tree on the right.
Yeah.
So.
I'm pretty sure she doesn't do any composite works.
I'm just curious, given the variety of trees in the picture.
Yeah, definitely. I'm not sure. I just know in her artist statement she said that they were English and Italian gardens.
I think what you're seeing is that the second cone is the same as the fore cone, and then there's a tree in the background. But it does look like you're looking up a sequoia. But I think it's two separate trees. The trunk is different than
that's,
the branch.
Yeah, that's an optical illusion again.
Absolutely.
But that was my first thought too.
That's a good observation, yeah.
So very interesting work that treats landscape in a different sense.
Is it large format? Does she print them like huge?
Yeah. I'm not sure what the actual print size of these were, because I saw them when she was sharing them in a lecture format similar to this. I did not see the works in their framed gallery setting. I would assume since they're palladium prints, they're not going to be large because palladium is very precious and costly material. So typically palladium prints, I mean, you can see some larger, but this would be like a huge palladium print. Typically palladiums are like more about this or even smaller, and you often see them because they were made in the historic period at which that was the best technology available too, which, you know, photographs used to be, we're used to printing them so large now. I mean, photographs used to be these very small things, which, you know, made photographers like Ansel Adams making these larger prints like, whoa. You don't see those every day. You don't have, you know, large printers where you can crank out sheets of ink on paper. Because as I know very well, doing darkroom photography, and I'm sure some of you have too, to make a print using light sensitive chemicals, you have to have like bins of chemicals that are then, if you're making a print that's this big, you have to have four trays that are that big, full of that much of the chemistry that you have to buy and mix and prepare, let alone the cost of the paper itself. So it's an interesting thing about working with historic processes. It's so material oriented that it does have constraints. And that's what's interesting to me about some of these works too, and then ones that I'll show you by another photographer, Sally Mann, is the intimacy of seeing smaller landscapes. It's fascinating as well. But I just love this series because of how it both shows beauty and constraint and built, but also has that small, like, upsetting of your expectations, or and sort of capturing the wild spirit that is stirring in those very well formed plants too, in different ways. Yeah. Any other final thoughts or comments? This work is similar, but very different in terms of using also historic process. And this is Sally Mann, and she does these beautiful, haunting landscapes in the Deep South. And this is from a series called Southern Landscape, and she's using collodion on glass plate, so it's called wet plate collodion, and built a dark room in the back of her car so she could drive out and then develop these negatives as she was out shooting, and just these amazing haunting landscapes. And she thought a lot about the history of the South. She talks about it as the South's obsession with death, and a lot of the difficult histories, especially around slavery and war, to hear stories of the land and a lot of the pain, and also very beautiful sweetness and nostalgia held in the land too. And she talks about trying to photograph the way that the air makes her feel when she's in this field, as both this kind of hauntingness and also a very deep, just visceral feeling of air and land and rootedness in a place that you grew up in, history, and the place where you grew up.
Is she doing the focus, the selected focus, on camera, or is it in the dark room? Oh no, you did say that she processes
the focus.
Yeah. So for like the softness, the selected focus, mm-hmm. how is she doing that on camera while she's shooting it?
Yeah, a lot of the softness comes from a very narrow depth of field, yeah. which you can control by the aperture. So if you have a wide aperture, mm-hmm. you have a shorter depth of field. So there's a lot of that you control when you're taking the photo. But then everything that's happening around the edges, like here you get a lot of softness around the edges yeah. that would be in focus. And that's from just the like edge glare of using a large format camera, and from the pore of using wet plate collodion.
What about the upper corners are all consistently?
That's part of the,
it's like lens flare kind of thing. So from having a wide angle or sort of, it's just the constraints of the lens and the kind of camera that she's using.
Today, there are apps that can do that.
Yeah, I was going to say, I mean, if you're on Instagram, there's a filter that's vignette, and the vignette effect, and even then, it's a literary term too, vignettes, come from actually the camera.
It's another app called Hipstamatic. Mm-hmm. And it does all these vintage things, and it's just unbelievable. And I printed them myself, and it looks like you actually got it done the way that these amazing artists are doing it, you know, without any sort of app filter and things like that.
That's genius.
That's genius.
Well, I mean, it's interesting because photography now, it's like it's not interesting to have a normal, clear photo in the way that it was interesting when that technology was new. So there's this, I think, deep sense of nostalgia about the rareness and preciousness of photographs and their connection to history in time and place. And so by putting a filter on that does this, it's almost trying to capture something about the magnitude of that moment or show it as this older or historic or nostalgic thing in the moment, then you're already referencing something that's this historic and precious or momentous or nostalgic sort of thing. It's interesting how photography and how we see historic photography now, then there's almost this longing to have that even as we have technological advances. Some of the beauty that comes from the process itself or the rarity of having a large format camera that, you know, the lens would do this, or working in the dark room where if you ever see a thing that shows the edges of a photograph that look kind of like scraped or different around. It actually comes from having a filed out negative. So if you file the edge of the film carrier, then light comes in around the square where the image was, and so you get that kind of effect. So it's interesting to see the way that darkroom process or historic methods then become duplicated through new technology. And I think it's a wanting to, you know, suddenly have your photos look like have this extra weight to them, or historicness or added beauty that comes from the process. I'm curious if you have other thoughts on that. It's an interesting question.
Do you carry a small triangular file with you to file the edges?
I do not. I have my favorite film carrier or negative holder because, that's.
Maybe it has something to do with importance as well as beauty or nostalgia or something.
That's
true.
Definitely.
It's also this idea that everything that we want today in life, we want it right away. Mm-hmm. So instantly, there are these things that can give you an immediate access to, I want it to look vintage, I want it to look this or that. It's just, the beauty of it is also how you use it is very important. I mean, everybody can do it, but you ultimately get an amazing piece.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really intriguing images. So you can probably see now when you see some of my pieces again, a bit of the influence that all of these different artists have had on me and my work. And I talked about these, was that yesterday? I think that was just yesterday. Holden Time Warp. And writing about the role of theology in land and landscape too. So I've been talking a lot about different artists and want to talk a little bit about theology and theological understandings of land. But you can see with these, I mean, this particular set of three images, a real desire to capture some of what these other artists were doing in how they're working with land, both an attention to the quiet beauty and to the story of a particular place, to listening to what that what the land evokes or stirs up, and holding a both a fragile and ephemeral and kind of mysterious and sometimes haunting kind of nature to it. And I talked yesterday at Vespers a bit about how land functions as a part of narrative too. And I think when we imagine land, landscape, nature as a part of biblical texts, I know I immediately would think of, oh, the Psalms and sun and mountain and beauty and praise. And that's such an important part of the singing and liturgy of Israel and our scriptures. And that sense of beauty and connection and gratitude is, and awe and wonder is incredibly important. But there's so much more than that too, especially when you remember that this community was an agrarian community. And my favorite theologian on this, her name is Ellen Davis, and she writes a great little book called Scripture, Culture, and Agriculture. A reading of, a reading of the Hebrew scriptures through the lens of an agrarian society. And she talks about the importance of land as ancient Israel was this very land-based agrarian community, and the way that the earth stands between the relationship of the people and God, and is continually a part of that story. And what's fascinating to me in making these works, which I talked about a bit with connection to both the story of Cain and Abel and the earth being caught up in this story about injustice and falling apart of relationship, that the earth was suffering and there is alienation between humanity and the earth, that's part of that story. And then the text of the dry bones in Ezekiel and the stirring up of breath and soil and breathing life and hope into this dusty, dry valley that was thought to be hopeless and desolate. And holding those narratives together, and then throughout the prophets, you see the land as a standing right in the middle of the relationship between humanity and God. And I think that asks a really important question of us today, when we have such a fraught and troubled relationship with the land, acknowledging the realities of global climate change and how much we've extracted and abused the resources of the earth. And what that means for us as a faith community, I think it's a very deep crisis of faith, and it's a moral question and it's a scriptural question. And so thinking about those more difficult and challenging and complex narratives and questions when we think about land and landscape as a part of story, important too, and something that I think about a lot in making art. So just as an example, I thought I would share a reading from Isaiah. And this is one that stuck with me because of just how drastic it is and how much land imagery there is. So Isaiah 24, verse 4. You can tell that ancient Israel isn't doing so great at this point in time. The prophet writes, "The earth dries up and withers. The world languishes and withers. The heavens languish together with the earth. The earth lies polluted under its inhabitants. For they have transgressed laws, violated the statutes, broken the everlasting covenant. Therefore, a curse devours the earth. The wine dries up, the vine languishes, and the merry-hearted sigh." And it just continues on and on about the ruins and destruction that's happening to the land. And it's all tied up in the fact that there is a lack of justice on the earth. And then it goes from that And then it gets, it's a pretty bleak look. It says, the earth is utterly broken. The earth is torn asunder. The earth is violently shaken. The earth staggers and sways like a hut. Its transgression lies heavy upon it, and it falls, and it will not rise again. And just how heavy that image is of the earth being polluted and swaying and staggering and falling apart, I think speaks to our current realities in a very profound way. Because it was speaking to a breaking of the covenant between God and God's people. But then a word of hope follows it in chapter 25. And this is immediately after all of this destruction, the beautiful passage about, on the mountain the Lord of hosts will make for all the people a feast of rich food, a feast of well-aged wines, of rich food filled with marrow, of well-aged wine strained clear. And the Lord will destroy on this mountain the shroud that is cast over all people, the sheet that is spread over the nations, and will swallow up death forever. The Lord God will wipe away the tears from all faces, and the disgrace of God's people God will take away from all the earth. For the hand of the Lord will rest on this mountain. I just think those parallel images are so profound, both a holding of the very real responsibility and destruction, and also this eschatological kind of end times word of hope and restoration and promise that are held together. So wanted to bring those texts and voices to close our reflections on all of these images of land as well.
Thank you.
Yeah.